CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 136, with Dr. Alison Chu, finding your path and becoming a leader in ophthalmology, and great pearls from this Australian ophthalmologist. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I've got a very special friend, and that is Dr. Alison Chu from Sydney, Australia. Now, Alison Chu is an absolute rising star, in fact, a big star in the ophthalmology world, specializing in cataract and refractive surgery. Alison, welcome to our podcast.
Uday, thank you so much for having me. It's really such an honor to be here. I mean, you're one of the world's most renowned ophthalmologists, so successful, and I'm honored that you would have me here today.
Well, I've learned so much from you. I've heard you at the podium. You're a gifted, talented speaker, and you have like really great, just down-to-earth pearls. You've done a lot more keratorefractive surgery than I have, like by probably an order of magnitude.
I don't know about that. Look, I was very lucky when I started out. I was mentored by Dr. Con Moshigov, who started an amazing practice in Australia called Perfect Vision. And it really was one of the leading refractive practices in Sydney. And he was the principal surgeon, and he took me under his wing, and we did huge volumes. We did huge volumes together. So that's where I got my experience really early on. Con eventually left that practice, leaving me as the principal surgeon. And then sadly he passed away during COVID. So,
Oh my goodness. I didn't realize. Yeah.
Did you ever meet him? He was often at Hawaii. Yeah. Yeah. And he used to go to the American meetings, and he was such a wonderful person and a really well-known surgeon worldwide. So.
Wow. I'm sorry to even hear that. I didn't realize. Yeah. I met him maybe first 15, 18 years ago on a trip to Australia, and just thought he was very charismatic and obviously very talented guy.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I mean, he was amazing. I mean, his memory still lives on. He had such a lasting impact on our profession, especially in the space of laser vision correction. So we definitely have not forgotten him. It's been a few years now. But, you know, COVID really was, it was a cruel time for many, you know, families and lots of people, lots of great people were lost. Well, wasn't it, you know, the ophthalmologist in China that first sort of brought COVID to the forefront, to the knowledge of COVID, passed away. And I think also we had some Italian colleagues too, but there must have been many more.
No, for sure. Even, yeah, here in LA, I know of one or two. So yeah. It was a strange time for sure.
Yeah, well, thankfully we passed those times too, you know.
So how'd you get your start in ophthalmology of all things?
I took a bit of a roundabout sort of pathway, actually. That's an interesting question. So I did not know that really I wanted to study medicine. I was not the best student at school. And I went to university and I was studying a science degree. I really didn't know what I wanted to do. And I sort of thought about medicine, but I wasn't sure. You know, when you're 17 years old, very young, you know, making a decision that's a vocation, you know, I was not mature enough to make that decision. So I did my medical science degree. And then I thought at one stage I might be interested in dentistry. My father's a dentist. And then I sort of went down this rabbit hole of doing deep research, and that ultimately culminated in a PhD. But I really decided in thinking about dentistry, you know, really I just want to do something surgical. I want to do maxillofacial surgery. And then I was going to have to do a medical degree as well as a dental degree. So I thought, you know what, I'm just going to do medicine and pick a surgical specialty. So I pretty much knew it was going to be something in this region. I knew it was going to be something quite fine and detailed, because that's my personality type. And, you know, I actually just feel, and at the same time I finished my PhD when I was in med school, so I eventually got both done. And I just feel really grateful that I picked ophthalmology, because it's an incredible specialty to work in, is it not? Like, I feel like there are, you know, a number of really good medical specialties. I feel so lucky that I happened to pick a specialty that is well suited to my personality. You know, don't we all have like at least a little bit of OCD or something going on there.
Yeah. All ophthalmologists are a little bit crazy. I've never met one who's not a little bit crazy.
A little bit, but you need to have that attention to detail because of what we're doing day in, day out. So, you know, I love my job so much. I just feel so lucky that this, you know, I chose this and this chose me because it feels like a good fit. And I couldn't ask for anything better in terms of a career. How about you? I want to only hear about you.
I'll tell you a quick side story, though. I have a good friend of mine who's a general surgeon, does these big abdominal surgeries, and he refers to ophthalmology as eye dentistry, which I think is so fitting. I mean, that's like, it's kind of what it is, right? There's little micro procedures on some little tissue. The only thing is that dentists are actually smarter than ophthalmologists.
Why is that?
Because here in the U.S. at least, we're so shy of charging a few little bit of money for the best vision of your life. So you can it'll change the way you see it forever. Meanwhile, we got dentists. We got dentists for thousands per tooth, and you've got a whole mouthful of teeth.
I think that too. I sometimes think that, especially seeing what happens in the cosmetic space and the amount of money that people are willing to spend. And we restore sight and we give people, you know, their vision back, or we give them vision without aids, without glasses. And I think sometimes we really do undervalue ourselves. There's not that many of us. Like across Australia and New Zealand, there's 2,500 ophthalmologists, and not all of those are practicing. I think I'm pretty sure I've got the figures about right. They might not be exact, but I think it's under 2,000 practicing ophthalmologists. So I would say maybe most of us do surgery, right? Most of us do, you know, cataract surgery, but some of us don't, because they've gone into more specialty areas like neuro-ophthalmology or medical retina, but most of us do. But still there aren't that many of us doing this.
Right. Wow, that's a smaller number than I kind of anticipated.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are fewer plastic surgeons. You know, I have a couple of friends that are plastic surgeons, and it's extraordinary the low number of plastic surgeons. It's only in the order of about 500 across Australia and New Zealand. So, you know, I mean, we're more common than plastic surgeons, but I do think, and I think we could perform around 300,000 cataract surgeries a year in Australia. I mean, the US would be magnitudes larger than that. But, you know, that's the world's most common surgery. That's our country's most common surgery by far. And, you know, the success rates are pretty amazing when you think about what's achievable in medicine in terms of our outcomes. You know, I think, you know, when patients come and they want to talk about, of course, we're going to talk about the risks and benefits of surgery. But, you know, you would know too, you do see the occasional patient that is scared of surgery and scared of cataract surgery, and you don't want to talk them, you know, you don't want to talk them into it. You never want to talk a patient into surgery. But when if you look back at your career too, Uday, if we look back, touch wood, right? There's no real disasters in terms of vision, right? Touch wood. Yeah. And if there are, if you've been a surgeon that's been unlucky enough, because that's just bad luck usually, if something like a suprachoroidal hemorrhage, let's say, that's just bad luck. So if you're a surgeon that's been unlucky enough in that regard, then again, that is also a rare occurrence. So, I mean, our success rates really in this field are pretty good. And don't you think that's partly what makes us happy people in terms of, you know,
It does. We're able to make patients very happy. We have a ridiculously high success rate. But you know the crazy part is, it's just not enough. You can have a 99% rate of patients getting 20/20 after laser vision correction.
Yeah.
And we're so crazy, we focus on the 1% who are like 20/25.
We do. I mean, I don't know about you, but I think about those patients that fall short, even though invariably, usually we can get them there with a second procedure. Those right. are the patients I think about. You know, if I have right. to enhance somebody or do a secondary lens, you know, sometimes I wish they knew that I don't stop thinking about them until I get them 20/20 or better. Because it's just like, I know we can do better than this. But, you know, there are some things that are out of our control, of course. But we get them there usually in the end, right?
Right. Sometimes, though, it's hard to even explain to a patient that, you know, the results of your surgery are half my surgery, my procedure, my technology, my technique. And half of it is your anatomy, your healing response, your tissues. I mean, the lens calcs are right here. I did them correctly.
Yeah.
It's just that you, well, you're a bit of an outlier in the way you ended up healing and your effective lens position is a little different and what you gonna do?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, we put a lot of effort and the formulas are so good now, right? We put right. a lot of effort into getting the measurements right, the yeah. ocular surface, of course, you know, making sure there's good fixation, looking at all of that, analyzing all of that. You know, developing our own, you know, sort of algorithms with how we do that. Right. And, you know, when you're a high volume surgeon, you're really afforded that, you know, because you get to audit your results and have a look at the feedback and get a good feel for where you're going with things. But, yeah, that's right. It's not all within our control. And, you know, we had, and I'm sure we still do have some laser vision correction centers that offer free enhancements. And, you know, I mean, of course, that sort of makes sense within the first 6 months, 12 months or whatever. But when I actually first joined Perfect Vision, they had a lifetime guarantee.
They lifetime?
So apart from something else developing in the eye, that was Con Moshe Goh's practice, apart from something else like cataract, if they had regression of their script, or, you know, pre-cataract changes or something else, you know, not macular related, nothing else related, but just related to their script, they would get an enhancement. So when I joined, one of the first things I said is, I'm not doing that.
Yeah, that's to me, that's I don't know about that.
No, because I mean, you know, people, their scripts change, you know.
It's age related, for sure.
Yeah, and if you've tried to ensure that they're stable before you go ahead and then they continue to change, that's out of your control. So, look, I think it was great for patient trust, but I don't think it was good for surgeon enhancements, right?
Well, I think it sets unrealistic patient expectations.
Yeah, imagine if you had a whole practice full of hyperopes. Like, I know some people that I know some surgeons that start in a laser center, and they get all the work that nobody else really wants. So they get left to learn, you know, sort of start their laser career on the hyperopes. Like, that'd be a nightmare, right? Imagine having that guarantee. I mean, of course, you're going to usually end up enhancing somebody's hyperopic if they haven't had their, you know, if they're treated on their manifest, not their latent, or they just tend to regress the hyperopes. Anyway. I mean, actually, my practice when I was with Perfect Vision, you know, I was doing a lot more keratorefractive work. I was doing a lot more lasers. But actually, over the years, and I think, you know, laser refractive surgery, you know, you can get a lot of volume. I don't want to say it's a less discerning population, but that younger group of people is easier to target with marketing. So there are people with not much experience that can get busy through spending a lot of dollars on marketing, right? But I think the intraocular volume, it does take longer to build that trust. And really over time, that's the part of my practice that you know, really has built year on year. And, you know, I mean, you're the cataract guru, Uday. So,
yeah, for sure.
You know, you would know that too. I mean, I've seen you operate. You're an excellent surgeon. You know, being in your operating theater was such an experience for me. I loved watching you operate. You know, many, many, many times I've learned, you know, those less usual, less, you know, more complex things from Cataract Coach. You know, our patients don't really understand. I have many friends outside medicine and outside ophthalmology that when I, you know, talk about, oh yeah, I'm going to watch a YouTube video about how to suture an enamel segment or something like that, they laugh at me. They're like, what, you're learning surgery from YouTube? And it's like, yeah. So yeah. Thank you for that library. I just want to say that. Yes. I mean, how many videos do you have on there?
At this point, 2,700.
Yeah, that's incredible. And it's not just
you the every day
stuff. It's the routine as well. It's mm-hmm. like, here's a little tip on hydrodissection, or here's a little tip on the wound, that the bread and butter everyday stuff. It's not just the complex stuff.
So yeah, for sure. I also think as a surgeon, as a cataract refractive surgeon, refractive cataract surgery is more fun than refractive corneal surgery, at least for me.
I love it. I love all of it. I mean, I think where we are now, right? I mean, where we were 10 years ago, it's so much more interesting now with what we have available to us in terms of the IOL technology and what we can do and what we've learned with the formulas getting better and our results getting better.
Well, speaking of which, you have access to IOL technologies many years before we have them in the U.S.
Yes, yes and no. Well, you've had a couple of lenses arrive on your shores before us. So a couple of multifocals you've gotten earlier than us. We don't have the light adjustable lens at all. I don't see that coming in our near future at all.
I just think it's a small player in the segment. I don't think it's, to me, it's kind of like using the pinhole aperture lens. I mean, it's for a very select few patients.
Yeah. I mean, that lens is marketed on label as a need-off lens, but I haven't used it as a need-off lens. I've used it for those aberrated corneas, for the post-RK patients. But yeah, we have a lot of lenses available, a lot of EDOFs, a lot of torics. We have low-power torics. And when I audit my toric usage, then most of my usage is in the lower end, actually.
Right.
So I think I'm using about 80%+ torics. It's unusual for me to have a list and have a non-toric. I mean, I sort of like it because it's, you know, don't have to take time to align everything and get the registration image with the digital registration. You know, it doesn't matter where you put that lens in, you can sort of, especially if it's an EDOF or a multifocal and it's non-toric, you can sort of rotate it to align with your Purkinje images better. But sometimes the way the haptics with a toric lens, it's got to sit in that particular axis. So if it's not aligned perfectly, you've just got to deal with it. But yeah, we're very lucky. I think we're really lucky in Australia. I think America, you know, it's interesting to be on the forums, you know, and hear and read and go to the conferences and speak to colleagues about the different technologies that we have in each of our countries and regions of the world. But, I mean, you guys are killing it in other areas, just not toric lenses.
Well, you know, if people are wondering, so in the U.S., we have most of our toric IOL options are basically starting at one diopter of the corneal plane and above.
Yeah.
If you look at a distribution of corneal astigmatism in the population, we really need toric IOLs that help address 0.5, 0.75 diopters of astigmatism. The reason those aren't FDA approved generally is a crazy reason. And that is that the FDA wants to see a two-arm study that the one patient get toric lenses, one get non-toric. So let's say the patient start off with 0.65 diopters of astigmatism on average. You have to, half of them have to go into an arm with a toric IOL and half with a non-toric IOL. And then you have to show a significant enough delta or difference between the two groups to get it approved. Mm. The crazy part here in the U.S. is we have toric lenses that treat one diopter, one and a half, two, two and a half, three, three and a half, four, four and a half, but none that treat 0.5, 0.6, 0.7, 0.8 diopters. That's the crazy part.
So your lowest toric lens is plus one.
Yeah, generally, like for Alcon, let's say, and I have no interest, financial interest with Alcon, but like the T3 IOLs is the lowest. We don't get T2.
So I get confused with the Alcon naming because they're the only ones that are on that T.
It's also so one diopter.
Is a T2, is a T2-1 and a T3-1.5.
On the IOL plane.
Yes, on the IOL plane.
Yeah, on the corneal plane, the T3 is about a diopter.
Yeah, right. Okay. So, I mean, we have 0.75, right, depending on the lens manufacturer. And then in some manufacturers, the lowest is 1. And then we can get as low as 0.5 for custom lenses with certain manufacturers, which I have used. And, you know, I will correct really low SIL depending on if the Barrett calculator shows me that it's the least residual. So I'll always flip the SIL as well if needed, just to leave the least residual. But I will err towards, if it's about equal, I will err towards leaving a little bit of with the rule astigmatism. And maybe even put in a non-toric if it leaves a little bit of with the rule over a toric lens, leaving a bit of against the rule, just to help with that depth of focus. But I can't remember the last time I performed an LRI or paired incision. So it was really interesting to watch those debates at the recent European conference, ESCRS, because, you know, we're really not using those techniques anymore. So it's interesting to hear the experience in that area.
Yeah, sometimes we're kind of limited by, again, with the technology that we've got FDA approved here. And so, yeah. I mean, US overall, the numbers are a little bit more than 4 million cataracts a year.
Whoa.
And about, yes, well, it's a big country, big place. We do a lot of surgery.
Yeah.
So, yeah, a little more than 4 million was for last year. And then the total keratorefractive, mostly LASIK market is about 600, maybe 700,000 in the U.S. per year.
Yeah. And so I'm interested to hear about the U.S. because I know in Europe, you know, there are some non-surgical ophthalmologists, ophthalmologists that do very high volume. And in Australia, most surgeons, so most ophthalmologists are doing cataract surgery, and most surgeons are pretty moderate volume, but then there's a smaller group of people that are doing high volume. So what's it like in the US? Most surgeons are doing cataract surgery?
So in the US, we have about 18,000 ophthalmologists, about 10,000 of whom are doing cataract surgery.
We got a
big group here. And then typically people who super specialize, the reason why not all of them do a cataract is if you do a, typically in the US, if you're doing a retina fellowship, your practice is essentially all retina and no cataract. Whereas around the world, people who do retina sometimes do half the time retina, half cataract. In the US, it tends to be a little bit more specialized where they just do that one thing. And so it's a little bit different. And then there's certainly the practices here in the U.S. that are only like keratorefractive surgery, or most, you know, 90 plus percent of what they do is just LASIK, let's say, or corneal procedures. But in general, I think the U.S. average ophthalmologist, if you just do a total mean, it's maybe about 400-ish cataracts per year per ophthalmologist. So let's say about 8 a week is pretty typical.
Yeah.
But then again, U.S. has that like kind of 80-20 rule where sometimes, you know, 20% of the surgeons end up doing 80% of the volume. And so there's some surgeons who are doing a lot more volume. But, you know, I mean, if you want super high volume, nothing beats two countries, Brazil and India. Those surgeons are amazing. Yeah. Like, I had a Brazilian surgeon I was talking to. Actually, I was talking to him in Copenhagen a week ago, who routinely does 20,000 cataracts per year. He does... But, you know, he does 400, 500 a week, every week.
That's incredible. I had no idea. Like, I have a friend in Germany. He does 4,000 cataracts a year. And I thought that was a lot. Because the high volume surgeons in Australia are really doing between like 700 and maybe 12 to 1,500. But that's unbelievable. In Brazil, that they're doing that kind, those kinds of numbers, and India,
It'll be a separate assembly. But those are kind of very, very large populations and very, very big backlogs of cataracts
and really amazing workflow. Really amazing workflow, where, you know, I've had the privilege not of being in Sri Ganesh's operating theatre, but having a look at the way his operating theatre runs via a video that he showed me. And the workflow is incredibly efficient. So we right. just don't have capacity to set the workflow up in that manner yeah. in Australia.
It also requires, it requires a lot of employees. So if you go to certain countries where cost of employees is really, really low, it makes it a lot easier. Like, you know, yeah. when I was with Amar Agarwal's meeting, he had to edit videos. He has an entire team. Their full-time job is editing surgical videos.
Do you have a team, you know, to edit your videos, or you're doing it all?
You're talking to the team. I'm the team. That's it.
Well, your videos are amazing. I know you've got some great recording equipment too. And, you know, you can tell it's all HD. And you need that. Right. You know, when you see a capsule, you know, especially even some of the surgeons that send videos into you, you can tell it's not the same quality. Like, you can't see the capsule right. and things like that.
I invest heavily into the fancy toys, fancy equipment for that.
Well, I mean, look, I mean, it's a whole brand, Uday. You've got your cataract coach and you've got 2,700 videos. Yeah. So, but it's not just that. It's the podcast. It's everything, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a passion project. It's a lot of fun, but I'm on a mission. I'm on a mission to equalize or democratize surgical education.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in Australia, you're very lucky. You've got great training. Yeah. My experience as an outsider, every time in Australia, which is probably, I don't know, maybe six times by now, for ophthalmology, by the way, it's very collegial. Your meetings are fun. It's a very unusual place. You're very, very fortunate to have, you know, be an ophthalmologist in Australia, for sure.
Well, I think because we're a young country, right? We don't have we're not sort of weighed down by all the traditions and history. So I think that allows us to be, you know, the way we are, which is, you know, pretty. I mean, I think you're talking about Oscars, which is majorly fun. And I don't think that there's a conference like that in ophthalmology anywhere in the world.
Even the RAMSCO meetings are fun.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you came to the Updates conference too. That's a great conference right. as well. But I think maybe that's why, because we're not tied down by anything. We're just the way we are. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I've always had a great time traveling Australia. Certainly recommend it for my American colleagues. You definitely want to go learn some fun ophthalmology, see a different perspective. Another thing, too, is the sun in Australia hits differently.
Oh, now, it is hard. You know, we're the skin cancer capital of the world. So
you literally are. If you look at a global map with skin cancer, it's by far the highest incidence of skin cancer of any country on the planet.
Yeah. Yeah.
But also, that same UV light is causing cataracts.
Yes. Yes, that's true. That's true. I mean, I wonder, though, what the cataract rate is around the equator, the equatorial regions, compared to right. Australia, because we're not that close to the equator. But, I haven't worked in any of those countries. I haven't done any outreach work in any of those equatorial countries or even visited anybody in their operating theatre. But, yeah, our UV is really strong. And, you know, we tend, because the weather's beautiful, we tend to live a pretty outdoorsy life, a lot of us. So, you know, we have a lot of pterygiums. You know, that's people that often grew up out in the sunshine surfing or whatever. And I would really love to see somebody make some goggles for surfers that don't fall off them, that don't ruin their peripheral vision, that can protect their eyes from the UV. Because, of course, if you're skiing, you're wearing goggles and you're protecting yourself from that reflection off the snow. But when people are surfing, they're not wearing anything. Like, occasionally you see a surfer wearing, like, a hat that's like done up with a cord so it doesn't fall off. But I've never seen a surfer wearing eye protection.
Interesting. You haven't either. Maybe we could develop like a larger contact because contacts can block UV, or maybe an eye drop. If you have sunscreen, why don't we have an eye drop that has a UV block in it?
Love it. You're so innovative. I'm sure somebody could do something. You should get onto it, Uday.
No, I got way too much stuff going on already. I need.
So I knew this conversation, we were just going to go in a million different directions because there's so much to talk about. But you were saying that your passion project is to spread education across the globe because we are really lucky in Australia that we get an amazing surgical education. Like, I think most ophthalmology trainees would probably have done between 400 and 700 cataract cases by the time they finish their training. And that's not the case all over the world. So I
Right.
was going to ask you, when did you make your first video?
Oh, I've been. Well, first, I got to acknowledge that I stand on the shoulders of giants, in particular, Bobby Osher, who to me is the godfather of ophthalmic surgical videos. So I learned from him for his video journal, Cataract Surgery, when I was a resident, gosh, 25 plus years ago. Amazing, amazing man. So now it's just taking this to the next level, which is. Let's just get this as a 5-minute video every day, spread it around the world, and let's just kind of keep up with teaching, not, all the secrets, basically, give away everything. Because you're right, there are some countries where, believe it or not, they don't have great surgical training at all. You can finish an ophthalmology residency and literally do zero cataracts.
Yeah,
So
I
how do we get
know.
this knowledge across to all these people? And so that's obviously a challenge. But yeah, I've been making videos for a very long time. It's actually a really crazy story how I got started making videos, which was literally my first year in practice in the year 2000. So I always loved surgery. And there was at that time the kind of an old guard still doing kind of what I call thought was backward surgery. They're doing a big retrobulbar block. They're doing a NADBAT block of the facial nerve, even so the patient wouldn't blink. They're doing these basically scleral incisions for phaco. They're bowling out the nucleus with just one hand. And these were surgeons in practice who would spend 45 minutes doing one phaco. And then obviously I pushed myself to learn, especially with Osher's, help in his videos. So I was doing topical anesthesia, phaco chop, clear cornea incision, and I was getting these cases done very efficiently. So when I first started practice, there were actually doctors in the community who were obviously threatened, who complained that I was doing sham surgery. They said there's no way he could do this surgery in whatever it was, 10 minutes or 15 minutes, whatever the number was. So
Yeah.
I rigged up in the year 2000. I rigged up a system using a beam splitter, and I had a handheld camcorder that recorded on DV tape, digital video tape. And then I'd rig it up so I could videotape every surgery I did, and it wasn't very low volume at that point. Just so that when they say no, I said, here's actually a video of the surgery.
Yeah,
And then
that's
now,
awesome.
even though it was low def, it was only standard def. It was 640 by 480 pixels was the max I could record. Even though it was low def. Then when I started to present at a meeting, people were doing PowerPoint, but they didn't really have video, or they wanted to switch over to the VHS machine. I had embedded video in PowerPoint in the year 2000,
Wow, back
which was
then.
right. It was MPEG
Yeah.
1, and it was obviously slow and whatever, but people were like, whoa, you have a video in your PowerPoint. And so then I got
Yeah.
invited there because all my lectures had videos in them. So I've been doing it
Yes.
for 20 years.
Yes. So isn't that incredible that where it started really was a pretty low moment, actually, where
Right.
reputationally you were being questioned, and that's
Right.
what, caused you to start, to rig up this structure and start recording your videos. And, I think that that's such a life lesson, isn't it? That when
Yeah.
sometimes we encounter those most difficult moments, like as a surgeon, you couldn't think of anything worse than being reputationally challenged, that somebody would
Right.
question your ethics or your skills,
Right.
when you're insightful enough, which most of us are, to know where we stand and what our place is. But
Right.
often those hardest moments that the greatest things come. Like, look what you've created because of that moment, because of that
Right.
question. I love that. I love that so much that you had the fortitude, to do something about it And not only that, but you've grown it into something that's iconic across the world.
Yeah, just, you know what? We're just getting started, to be honest. It's so much fun. I learned so much. I learned way more than I teach. I mean, it just seeing great surgeons on the podium obviously is fantastic. I have the ability to travel to so many countries now. And then also all the videos that are submitting me.
What countries you haven't been to, right? I bet you the number of countries that you haven't been to is a smaller number than the ones that you have been to.
No, I don't know. But if they don't have an ophthalmology meeting, I'm probably not going. So that's one of the catches. You gotta have some sort of ophthalmology meeting so I can go to it.
What if you went to South America, you wouldn't, like Ecuador, you wouldn't take a side trip to the Galapagos Islands because there's no ophthalmology meeting there? We need to put an ophthalmology meeting there.
No, for sure. You know, even when I was in Copenhagen, I stayed one extra day so I could do some sightseeing. And that's a tiny town. You can easily see the entire place in a day.
Yeah.
I always enjoy.
I don't know if I told you, but I stayed one extra day too, but I didn't stay in Copenhagen.
Where'd you go?
I went to Stuttgart.
Oh, nice. There you go. Yeah.
Lifelong dream to go to the Porsche factory. So managed to pull it off. I think I was in that town for about 6 hours and then drove to Frankfurt to catch my long, long plane home.
All right. That's the one challenge with Australia is anywhere you go, it's going to be a long flight.
It's a beautiful country, but it's a day to fly. I think it took me 24 hours to get home.
Now, tell me about, so you were saying earlier that you did, at 17 years old, basically, you have to make a decision whether to go to med school or not. U.S. Yeah. is different in that we all do university when we're 17 or 18 for 4 years. We earn a bachelor's degree. Then we apply to medical school for the MD degree, which is 4 more years. Then we do ophthalmology, which is 4 years after that, and then we can subspecialize with 1 or 2 more years of fellowship. What's kind of the process in Australia?
Yes, so good question. So there are undergraduate medical schools that we can go to, and there is also a graduate program where it's a similar system to what you're describing. So you do an undergraduate degree first, and it can actually be any undergraduate degree. It's not a prescribed, predefined pre-med degree. Mm-hmm. It can be a law degree, a science degree, an arts degree. It's just, I think, doing a science-based degree gives you some basis to, you know, doing those sort of health-related subjects when you start med school because, it's a long time ago. I have to try and remember, but I'm pretty sure when I started med school, we really just didn't do physics, chemistry, which is in the older undergraduate medical degrees. You know, first year is boring, physics, chemistry, maths, biology, plus, you know, pathology, physiology, anatomy, and those sorts of things. But with the graduate program now that's been around for ages, since I started medical school, I think the first graduate program entry medical school was in the late 90s. So you can go either pathway. I mean, I actually was given an undergraduate medical school place, but it was a couple of hours drive from my hometown, from Sydney. And I actually didn't turn up. I thought that I had withdrawn from this medical school place, and they rang me on the first day because it's not normal for somebody not to turn up to med school on the first day. And so they rang me and they're like, "You're starting medical school today." And I'm like, "Oh yeah, no, I didn't want to come. I thought I'd withdrawn." And I did it the similar way to what it's in the US because I just wasn't sure. And so I did a science degree first, and then I got sort of a bit distracted by research and started my PhD. But then I entered the graduate medical program, which is 4 years. But I think the difference is one of the big differences between the US and Australia is you guys stream really early. So we do a lot of years before we actually get onto an ophthalmology training program.
General medicine.
We do general medicine. So we do a year of internship, And then we do residency. I did a year of surgical training, and then I went and became a physician registrar. And that was 3 years. And that's about the minimum that it takes to get onto an ophthalmology training program. And I think I was very lucky because I already had my PhD. I'd finished it and I had a higher degree, because one of the things you need to have here, which doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be a better clinician, but it's just, you know, because it's so competitive to get in, they've had to sort of set the bar and put in other barriers in place. But there are some people, Uday, that do 8 or 9 or more years of general medical. They might do an unaccredited ophthalmology year. They might do something completely different, like start a career in emergency medicine or whatever, before they get onto the ophthalmology training program. And like in the US, you know, there would be a proportion of people that just don't get on because it's super competitive and crazy.
Wow, I didn't realize that you had to do all those extra years. No wonder there's so few ophthalmologists in Australia. You got to drop some of those barriers, you got to streamline it.
You think because they make it too hard. They make it very hard, but I'm sure it's hard in the US too. I mean, there's a certain subset of specialties that are really hard to get into. So dermatology, ophthalmology, I think ENT surgery, plastic surgery, those are probably, I'm sure there are others that I can't think of at the top of my head because it's been a long time since I was in that space. But, you know, like anywhere, you know, there are the more popular specialties. So it's just a supply-demand issue, right?
Yeah, so U.S. is obviously very competitive, and they've now, it used to be like when I trained, a one-year internship and then 3 more years of ophthalmology residency. Now they've combined it into just 4 years total, and your first year is only 9 months of general medicine and then 3 months of ophthalmology, and then the next 3 years are all ophthalmology. So you do a total of 39 months of ophthalmology out of 48.
Wow. Okay. So I think in years gone by, our program was 3 years and then it turned into 4 years. And that was sort of well before my time. And now we have a fifth year. So our fifth year can be a fifth general year or it can be a fellowship year. So most people try to do a fellowship year. Yeah. So that's why you guys are so young.
If you go straight through, like I went straight through, I finished maybe about age 30, I could start my private practice.
Yeah, that's incredible. Yeah. Well done. Yeah, no, congratulations. I mean, to start your private practice, you know, when you come out too, that's incredible.
Yeah, my private practice where I did my first month, I did one cataract.
I think that's great in your first month. I remember my first year in private practice. I think I did about 5 cataracts in my first year.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No one tells you the hardest part of your practice is just getting a patient in the door.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
That's the hardest. And especially if you have a baby face and you have no gray hair, they're like, wait a minute, how old are you, kid? So
yes, I can imagine. So I don't think I get those comments anymore, but I used to.
Now, I've also noticed there are a good number of like UK physicians, ophthalmologists, who then come and practice in Australia. I've seen, is that something that's common now?
Yeah, I don't think that's very easy, but there are some that come. So Australia is really strict about overseas trained ophthalmologists, and it doesn't matter if they've been really well trained, like in the UK or the US or elsewhere around the world. And I mean, of course, the training across the world is highly variable, but they are really strict. So unless they come under some special sort of category, and that is, you know, well-known, strong research, I'm not involved in that selection criteria, but I am aware that some ophthalmologists have come across under that category. Then there's another way to come, and that's area of need. So you basically go out to the country, because we've got this vast land and most of these are concentrated to, you know, the East Coast and down south a little bit. And, of course, there's Western Australia, Perth on the on the West Coast, but there's not a lot in the middle of the country. Yeah. And so, you know, there's an area of need. So you're basically bound to that area for X number of years. So that's another way to come. But for a lot of people, they have to basically redo some or all of their training.
They
know what their experience has been, but our council, RANSCO, our governing body, really want people to be, even if you're subspecialized at a certain point in your career, they would want you to have broad and deep experience in every subspecialty. So pediatrics, neuro-ophthalmology, glaucoma, retina. So,
Oh, boy. That's tough.
So those people have often been asked, please, can you go and do 12 months of pediatrics or 6 months of pediatrics to show that you're also experienced in this area? And, like, I think that's so harsh, because if you asked me to run a pediatric list today, it would be challenging. Because I just don't do or see much peds anymore. And if you'd asked me 5 years ago, it might not have been that bad. And 10 years ago, I would have had no problem. But today, like, I'm just so subspecialized in cataract and refractive, I, you know, would have to get out my Will's Eye Manual and check it.
That's absolutely true. Like, I had a patient recently where, you know, the patient had one of these like white dot syndromes in the retina. And so I guessed what it was and I sent it to my retina colleague. And he was just like, yeah, nice try, but no, that's wrong. Like, okay, I tried. I don't know all the white dot syndromes in the retina.
I think he did really well to pick it as a white dot. I'd be like scratching my head going, is that one of those white dot things I learned about for my exam?
Right. But no, we get ultra, ultra specialized. Now, tell me about your new practice. I see behind you, it says Pure Sight Eye Surgeons. Tell me about the practice.
Yes. So I opened my first practice 4 years ago in the middle of COVID, because I thought that that would be a great idea. And I opened that in the outskirts of Sydney. So it's actually an hour drive from my home. And, like, that's a proper hour, Uday. Like, I know an hour drive in LA might just be I'm sitting in traffic for an hour, but it's a proper hour drive. It's at the base of the Blue Mountains. So it's almost considered a regional area.
And very west, the west part of the city, way west.
Yeah, west, way west, way west. So you drive as far, it's a bit northwest actually, so you drive as far as you can before you hit the Blue Mountains. So we started in a tiny little heritage cottage that was out the front of a shopping centre, so a bit sort of retail frontage, and within 18 months we'd outgrown the place, so we relocated to a place that was sort of triple the size. And then, so that was about, I think, 2.5 years ago. And I just really loved that work. And it showed me really that I could do it. So I actually finished my training. I think I did my final exams in about 2010 or 2011. I did my fellowship in 2012 with Con Moshagov. And my first year in private practice was 2013. So this was like a long time coming. But, you know, I had a young family. It just felt like all too hard. And, you know, starting that practice really showed me I can actually do this. So I decided to start a more city-based practice, and we only opened that practice this year. And because we now have two locations, which is not many in the scheme of things, but when you've got a baby, you know, it's your baby, we decided to rebrand to Pure Sight Eye Surgeons. So that only sort of came about this year, because then I had this grand plan. I'm like, well, what if there's more than two? You know, we need to have, you know, a name that can cover different locations. So it fits for now because we have two locations. But, yeah, it's been really exciting. It's a smaller sort of boutique practice. It's really – I started my first practice. I'm like, I see everything. Doors are open. Bring them in. Whatever you've got, I'll see it. And, you know, fortunately, I've gotten to a point there now where I have other excellent surgeons working there that have other subspecialty interests as well, like retina and stuff. So really, I'm only seeing the keratorefractive and cataract patient population out in that practice. And that's what this newer practice is also designed to be. And it's much closer to my home. So it's really close to the center of Sydney City. So it's probably about, to put things in perspective, maybe a 10-minute drive, so a few kilometres out of the city. Yeah, really close, so it's nice. I still work in someone else's practice in the main medical strip of Sydney, like it's the high street of medical specialists in Sydney. So I now have those two places quite close by, but we'll see what happens over time.
Yeah, you know what ends up happening is it ends up growing and growing. But you know, I did a lot of similar things to you where I start off with kind of multiple plate spinning, multiple things going on at the same time. And you never know which one really takes off.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, you're bang in the center of Beverly Hills.
Right.
Yeah.
So I did the same thing. So when I first finished my training, I did one practice in kind of the west side of LA, Santa Monica, where I shared space at someone else's clinic. And then I set up a from scratch clinic in the outskirts of LA in a Spanish speaking neighborhood where I speak good Spanish. So I had a great time there.
Amazing.
And then I just both grow. And then finally, after about 6 years, I ended up just like, oh, you know, I need to be practicing only on the fancy part of LA. I need to be in Beverly Hills. So I just kind of okay to switch gears, and that's what I ended up doing. And so I agree with you now. My practice is just one location, and it's boutique.
Yeah.
And that's the way I like it.
I mean, you have an incredible practice. So how long have you been in Beverly Hills for? When did you make the decision to only be in the one location?
2006. So I finished my training in 2000, and then by 2006, I decided, like, okay, I'm done with the other locations. I'm going to do just keratorefractive. Before first 6 years, I did everything to walk through the door.
Yes.
I'll do everything. Because I thought I had great training. Yes. So I didn't mind doing eyelids, strabismus, glaucoma, cornea, cataract, everything you want. I'll do everything much as I can.
Yes.
But then in 2006, I said, okay, only cataract and refractive. And so that's been now 19 years. And then, it ends up, you just, as you were saying, you just build a momentum there. It gets so busy. We went to have lunch after I did my surgeries, and there in the elevator, we see that's one of my patients.
We saw your patient. He recognized you. I thought that was gold, actually. That's so nice.
Right. So then I do zero advertising, zero marketing. But I think it's just such a strong word of mouth.
Yeah.
That there's no question. They just refer their friends, and then you just, there's kind of a endless supply.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the beauty. We get to pick our own pathway, right? And we get to pick and choose the things that we love the most. We get most enjoyment from the things those are the things really that we get the best at, right? So I remember running into that patient in the elevator, and he recognized you, and he was like so happy, like he was still smiling about his vision, and it was just such a lovely moment. That he would recognize you in the lift, which, you know, probably isn't uncommon for you, but witnessing that, I just felt so fortunate to be there in that moment to witness that interaction between the two of you, because he's like, oh, you fixed my vision, Dr. Devka, oh, it's you. It was so lovely. It was really, really lovely.
No, we're so blessed. That's probably the beauty of this. You know, if I had done like his like colorectal surgery, he may not have been as happy, right? So, I mean, doing ophthalmology is such a beautiful field. We're so, so lucky,
Yeah, I think we're super lucky. Like, I feel so blessed to be in this specialty. We get to be at the forefront of technology. We get to help patients with their vision. We get to see the smile on their face when we fix their vision. You know, we get to hear the stories about the positive impact that we've had on their lives. And it might be, I often can see the leaves on the trees. And then, of course, they go, I can also see usually the women, I can also see the wrinkles, I can see the dust. But, you know, they're the most common things. But, you know, I'll never forget this one patient I had. He had a lens that was opacified, and I was trying to put off, you know, exchanging this IOL as long as possible. But he came in and he said, look, I now have developed some medical problems. I have a stoma bag. I can't manage it. I can't see it properly. And so I did his exchange. You know, we managed to retain the capsule. I put a lens in the bag. And to hear him talk about how his, you know, daily life had changed because now he could manage his stoma bag, it, you know, I'm not going to lie. I mean, I get tears in my eyes when I hear those kinds of stories. For sure. To feel and hear and see the impact, the positive impact that we can have on people's lives. And I, you know, that's why I feel so blessed. We get to do this every day. So, I mean, it's no small thing to have, even though we do the same thing every day, it's no small thing to have a patient there in front of you and you're about to do their surgery to be completely focused. I was really interested to see when I came to visit you and I, you know, had the privilege of being in your operating theater that you don't have any music. And each to their own, you know, everybody works differently. Some people work well off that space, some people don't. But I also don't have any music in my operating theater, and I used to. But as I got busier and busier, my focus needed to step up and become, you know, I needed to become more and more focused. So I really don't like a lot of noise in my operating theater, and I also don't have music, and I also find myself sometimes reminding people about what's happening in that room, because every surgery is important. Like, every patient's important.
Sure.
Every outcome's important.
Yeah, no, 100%. For us, you don't be make the mistake of thinking, well, this is just a surgery. No, it's not just a surgery. This will change this patient's view of the world every waking moment for the rest of his or her life. That's a huge deal.
That's right. And, you know, you want to be your best. You want to be able to do your best for that one individual surgery and for each and every patient, right? It's a privilege. It's an honor what we do. So, you know, I just like to, I'm so serious about it. I'm so focused about it because, you know, it's easy to get distracted, really. It's easy to be thinking about something else or listening to something else or having, I really don't even have much conversation. And that's just me. Everybody's different, right? So, some people will find that they're relaxed if they're talking or listening to music and it helps them with their performance. So I think we all, you know, are lucky that we get to pick and choose what works for us and to be able to really do that for people.
Yeah, find your zone where you can perform your best for every single patient. And yeah, for me, I'm like you. Quiet, no music, and no chit-chat. All my focus is just on that patient and that eye and right now, and that's it. Nothing matters. Kind of compartmentalize.
Yeah, I've seen you in theater. It's like a sight to see, really. I mean, your surgery is beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
We all do.
And well, you always got to make sure that you press the record button.
My staff's pretty good at that. Yeah, actually, I record on two things. I record within the microscope itself as a backup. Plus, I have a beam splitter and a separate fancy HD camera that I record on, too. I do both.
Nice.
Just in case. If one doesn't turn out, I've got the other video, et cetera. And then I come early. I always set the camera up, make sure the focus is perfect, do the white balance, do the brightness. I always do that ahead of time, at the beginning of the day. And I clean my optics. I'm so good. Like most ophthalmologists, I'm a little bit crazy.
Yes, we're all a little bit crazy, but for the right reasons, for the right reasons. We've all found our place. You know, we all just want to belong in this world, and we've all found a place where we can belong.
Absolutely. No, I got to tell you, thank you so much. I can't believe it's been an hour. We've already been talking for a long time.
No, thank you so much.
It's 7 a.m. for me. It's 7 a.m. for me. That means it's midnight for you. You should probably get a little bit of sleep.
Thanks, Uday. It's been such a pleasure. As I said, one of the most renowned ophthalmologists in the world and one of the best. And thank you for having me. It's been such an honor and a privilege to have this conversation with you.
My pleasure. You are the absolute future star here for key opinion leaders in Australia. I got to tell you firsthand, on the podium, you are just amazing. I take notes in your lectures. You're that good. So if anyone there in my audience has a chance to see Dr. Allison Chu on the podium in these international meetings, you got to go. You're going to love it. You're going to learn a lot.
Thank you so much, Uday.
You're welcome. Remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we got a new Cataract Coach podcast every single week on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, wherever you get your podcast, get the Cataract Coach podcast. Plus, of course, there's a new Cataract Coach video every single day, 2,700 days and counting. And now we even have a Retina channel. So there's a new Retina video as well and a Retina podcast on retinarounds.com. So until next time, I'll catch you later.